it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Buenos dias, chicas y chicos. Hello and welcome, a very warm welcome to the Joy of Paddle podcast, spreading and sharing the supreme delight of this wonderful and fast-growing game. I'm your host, Minter Dial, and this podcast is brought to you by Paddle 1969, the largest manufacturer of premium paddle courts, one court for life by Paddle 1969. The Joy of Paddle is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. For more information about the network, go ahead and check out evergreenpodcast.com. So this is the inaugural season of the Joy of Paddle podcast. And to start with, we're going to do an episode once every fortnight. Episodes will drop every other Wednesday at 12 noon London time. Please let us know what you think about the show by putting up a rating and review. So for this 10th episode of the Joy of Paddle podcast, I'm excited to bring to you Sandy Farquharson. Sandy's a member of the National GB Paddle Team, having developed as a tennis player and previously been coach of ATP and WTA players on the tennis circuit. In 2012, Sandy converted to paddle and participated in the development of the sport in the UAE. He has organized WPT and FIP tournaments, been the coach of the national teams in both the UAE and GB, and represented GB in the European and World Championships. He founded the Paddle School in January of 2019 to give the paddle community the tools to take their on-court performance to a new level, which will in turn grow the sport into a powerhouse across the globe. Sandy's an ambassador and a shining light for the sport. Vamos! Sandy, you are the maestro of the Paddle School, and great to have you on the show. The Joy of Paddle welcomes you. In your own words, how would you like to describe yourself, Sandy?
Well, thank you very much for having me, first of all, Minter. Absolute pleasure to be here. Describing myself, I suppose I would say that I'm a kind of community/people driven person, really. I enjoy, I'm sure we'll talk about this with paddle, but I enjoy the social aspect of paddle, and I'm, you know, a sociable person. I like to meet people. I like to travel, and so, you know, what I'm currently doing fits that quite nicely.
Indeed. Well, let's talk about your path into paddle, because obviously you're a great athlete. And what's your pathway, the credentials into paddle?
Yeah, so my pathway into paddle, my background was tennis before. So I played college tennis, and then I played pro tennis for a couple of years, and then coached on the tour. And I think it's probably worth saying at this stage that my education was in biomechanics of human performance. So, you know, a lot of what I did as a tennis coach, I also did the strength and conditioning side. I also did a lot of the kind of biomechanics when it comes to players' off-court routines. And so when it came to changing sports, that came in very useful. But my journey into paddle really is probably quite unique. I was in Dubai. I would finish my tennis coaching experience there. I cancelled my visa, sold my furniture. I was on my way out of Dubai, as it were, and someone dropped out of a paddle competition. And just sheer chance, it was the week before I was leaving. And I have quite a strong squash background, particularly as a junior. And I thought, you know what, I'll give it a go. It looks fun. It looks like something that I would enjoy. And we ended up playing that tournament and doing quite well in that tournament. And eventually I ended up winning that tournament with my Spanish partner. And that's probably more of a reflection on the level of the paddle there, as opposed to me just being a natural at the game. And at the time there were really only two public courts, and this was at a private facility. And after the final, I had my flight, like 2.5 hours after the final. So I had all my suitcases with me at the final and literally was right. I need to get, thank you very much. Fantastic tournament. I need to get to the airport now. I'm on my way out. And the management team there gave me a call on the way to the airport and said, look, you know, we really liked you. We think that you might be a good fit for managing the paddle facility or managing racket sports, but they didn't have tennis. And so I said, look, let me think about it. My whole background is in tennis. I'm making a jump to a sport that really no one knows. And at the time, I mean, there was, you know, there was, this is 12 years ago, there was no content in English. There was, you know, most of the country, Sweden hadn't even started. They hadn't even opened their first club at that stage. And so, you know, really no one knew about it. And in the end, I thought I was going to take a little bit of a punt. I was a bit frustrated with the tennis and how that was developing. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to go for it. And part of my agreement with the club, and actually it turned out to be His Highness Sheikh Hamdan's facility. So I was actually his coach and his rackets manager. Part of my agreement with them was I get to go to Spain and train with the coaches that I feel would help develop me as a player, but also as a coach for the coming years. And that's exactly what I did. So I spent the next 3 or 4 years taking dozens of trips back to see, you know, those influential people in the game. And quite often I needed a translator. My Spanish is, you know, pigeon's badging Spanish at best. And so, you know, the first course I had Horacio Clemente teaching me coach education, who's almost the godfather of paddle. And we had a translator for that. And I got all of his material in English. And that really started my journey in playing the game, but also, you know, coaching the game and understanding, you know, the methodology behind it and things like that. And so, you know, that was, like I said, 12 years ago. I've played tennis once in the last 12 years. There was not really a, you know, it just went from one straight to the other. And so, you know, I'm very thankful that paddle has grown in the way that it has. Otherwise, yeah, I may have had to make a jump back to tennis had it not.
Had it not grown so well. Just quickly, on the time you went back to tennis, did you find that your paddle helped or hindered?
It was a difficult situation. So my brother, who now works with me at the paddle school, he was playing on the tour. And so, and he was about 380 ATP. And I used to coach him when he was younger. And so he was one of the players I was on the tour with. And I went to hit with him in a warm up for a challenger event. And I'd played, you know, a couple of years of paddle at that stage. And he was hitting, I mean, he hits the ball so well and so heavily that I kind of immediately felt out of my depth. Yeah. And, you know, for me, it was everything from, you know, the way I was playing with continental both sides and, you know, the shortness of the racket. It just, you know, had I gone for a gentle hit with a friend, it probably would have been fine and I would have enjoyed it. But as it was, I found, you know, a real struggle. And so, it was difficult that one time in tennis.
Well, I, you know, when you need to perform and tennis, of course, has been evolving in its own way. I want to go back to that first game you had with your Spanish partner. So you've got your tennis background, some squash. You're playing with a Spaniard, and I'm guessing he couldn't have been so bad as well. But talk us through how much he was helping you to learn, and how he was instructive, pedagogical, helping you to transition into the game of paddle. Like, Sandy, don't hit it so hard. Sandy, you know, wait for the wall. You know, how much was happening in that game for you, and how much does that inform your way of helping, you know, tennis players into paddle?
Yeah, it's interesting. If I look back at it now, I was doing all the things that I am recommending players change about their game now. So, you know, I was rushing the net, I was playing fast volleys, I was hitting attacking smashes. And I played a lot of doubles. I played a lot of doubles in college. So I like that style of play, and I like coming forward and attacking the volley. And it's interesting because the Spanish in that tournament, like I said, the level wasn't a high Spanish player. I would say it was an intermediate or strong recreational player. So it's quite interesting, and I see this with coaching now, is that they were trying to articulate how to play, but not really understanding the methodology themselves. So it was very much a do what I'm doing, but I can't explain to you why what you're doing needs to be corrected, if that makes sense. And so, you know, really the main learning came the year after I joined Dubai, because I went on all of these trips and I started that role. And then a year later, we brought in a good Spanish player, and he came and he was coaching with me at the facility in Dubai. And I played a lot of one-on-one with him and learned a lot from him about, you know, defending the glass and almost breaking through that barrier of, you know, as a tennis player, I'm sure you'll see this a lot, Minter, is that players are always blocking and instinctively avoiding that glass. And it takes real time and effort to break that down. And, you know, and I spent months like trying to get through that and really getting frustrated with the double glass and the spins off the glass and understanding how to deal with those and where the ball would be and how I position myself. And I think all tennis players need to go through that before they can become a good paddle player. They might play, you know, tennis well on a paddle court and get like I was at the beginning, but until you really embrace those parts of the game in paddle, it's very difficult to get to a good level.
I get the feeling that it's almost like going through the wardrobe in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Once you've gone into it, you go through into this other world, it becomes so obvious to wait and let it hit the back wall. And until then, you're still half falling. You're still, well, I know how to do that. I don't know how to do that. Or I know intellectually I should be doing it, but I prefer to do this. And what does it take for someone to move through that?
I like that example, you know, the Narnia example, but for me it would be like having almost wardrobes within wardrobes, right? Because I think in that example, it's like you go through that first door and you think, right, I've got to learn the glass, you know, I'm really struggling, and you admit to yourself, right, I need to learn the glass. And then you start getting used to the glass, and then you say, right, well, I need to change my overheads, you know, I'm being far too attacking, I need to understand paddle overheads. Okay, great. Then you go through the next one, you say, well, actually, the way I'm approaching my points is far too aggressive, and I'm getting to where I'm trying to finish. So I need to change that mentality. And then it suddenly, you know, and this is what I love about paddle, is that as you get better, it gets more and more complex. And you know, I just come back from Chicago last night, and we had a couple of advanced players that were playing, and we were discussing the different types of lobs. So you have a high lob and a fast lob, and they hadn't really understood that concept and why you would do that. And that's an advanced concept, you know, that you kind of teach on how to get net players out of position. And so this is what I really enjoy about it, is that it's in stages, and you develop your game as you go and learn as you go. And that's, this is really where this guidance from a coach, well, this is exactly what we're trying to do with the paddle school, but this guidance along that journey to help you get better. Because if you don't have that, then it can be very frustrating and you end up plateauing, and, you know, well, we see it all the time.
I love it. I love how you describe the sort of the multi-layered Narnia. And to add to that, the other thing that I've observed, and you can comment, is paddle itself is also layering on new techniques, new methods. I mean, I was talking to one coach the other day who said, no, you don't do the gancho anymore. The best players, you know, Sanjo does, or maybe Bella, but for the rest, modern paddle, we've eliminated the gancho, which is the, just for those who are listening, the kind of a flat or straight arm overhead, where you're just pushing the ball back usually. When you're playing typically in the deuce court as a right-handed player.
Yeah, I mean, I find those sweeping statements, and I've heard that with the bandeja and the gancha, I find those quite entertaining. Because or if you
let us laugh, this is the joy of paddle.
well, the thing is you say that, you say, right, well, now the Bandeka is not in the modern game. And you watch through 30 seconds of LeBron playing on the right hand side, and you see he's hit three Bandekas, and you say, well,
who's he?
Yeah, well, exactly. And the bit I find really difficult, for, you know, this is a conversation I have with recreational players all the time. Is yes, but you know, these players now are hitting Vibras instead of Bandekas. I say, yeah, but. You know, this is, you're talking Sanyo at the World Paddle Tour level. And if you've ever watched him live, you will see that, I mean, he has phenomenal hands. And so, you know, it's a bit like saying on, you know, the tennis circuit that, you know, Nadal, you've got to hit your forehand how Nadal hits his forehand. But it doesn't work like that. You need to sort out the mechanics first. And, you know, again, it comes to, well, make slight changes in the grips like the pros. Well, first, get the game in continental grip and get your technique good. And then you can make the changes that suit you physically. But this is, you know, the idea that you don't have a Gancho or Bandeka anymore, I find is absurd, because, you know, there are players all the time playing that shot. And that's at the pro level. So you're going to find lots and lots of players, you know, an intermediate and learning level that are doing it. So, you know, this is an ongoing discussion. It's quite interesting, because a lot of the coaches that we talk to that are from a paddle country, a long-term paddle country, say, well, yeah, I wasn't taught the Gancho. So I don't think it's necessary now. And you say, well, that's not, you know, that's not how, you know, education works. Every individual is different.
Yeah, and for example, you know, if for me, the Gancho I find very necessary, because I'm not quick enough to get myself back into a position to do something else. And, you know, I also have to worry about my steam at my age. I can't be running just the same pace everywhere like a youngster can. And I wanted to get back into one other thing, which is an area of expertise on your side, is the biomechanical element. And I was wondering if you could translate for us if there is any difference in the way you do training and biomechanical elements of work relative to a lawn tennis or a squash versus paddle.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the major thing to consider when you're comparing the sports is, you know, racket head speed and generation of power. You know, you look at those two sports specifically, and you've got your squash where, you know, often you see the players lift their elbow and it's a lighter racket, a very light ball. And the racket head speed on squash is extremely high. You know, and tennis, really the same. The court is, you know, much longer, and their generation through the whole kinetic chain, you know, right the way from toes up till contact point, is a kinetic chain to develop power. Whereas the game of paddle is not about power. I mean, really, you would only use the power on, you know, the overheads or the aggressive shots that you want to finish the point. You're never going to see a pro player have a ball from the back and then absolutely drive their body and hit it as hard as they could. There would be no intention to doing that, you know, a risk reward. It's just not worth it. So when you take that into consideration, you then look back the chain on the biomechanics, and then, you know, for example, the tennis swing, you therefore don't need that loop. You don't need the leg drive into, you know, back front to foot, to back front to front foot so much. And so, you know, all of this combines. You've also got to realize that it's multi-directional movement that you're, you know, and this is where it's slightly more like squash, but it's, you know, the movement patterns are very different. And actually, the deeper you get in the game, the more you realize it is a different sport. And I think that if players and coaches can take that kind of appreciation from the beginning, that the faster they will improve. And it's interesting, we travel the world working with coaches, and you know, a lot of clubs think, right, well, I'm just going to put my tennis coach in to coach paddle. And you say, well, oh, that's interesting. Would you take your squash coach in to coach tennis? No, you wouldn't, right? Because it's a different sport. And so I think that appreciation needs to, or will come to light soon, right? When tennis coaches experience it, they see it. But until they do, they don't appreciate that.
Yeah, the net and the yellow fuzzy ball are deceitfully not the same. Talking about the paddle school, I've listened to several interviews of you with your brother, what you're doing there. Give us where you, what is the paddle school and where are you with it today?
So the paddle school really started and it kind of originated with creating some video content initially for my group of players. I was in Dubai. I was feeling I was explaining the same things over and over again, and there was no reference in English. I mean, this is a long time before English content was being produced. And so I just thought, right, I'm going to make this content for our group to answer basic questions, you know, things like grip and footwear and rackets and all that kind of stuff. And I made the first few videos and you'll kind of completely understand this. And, you know, I think my first video got 11 views and, you know, and I wasn't surprised. I mean, I was thinking, wow, 11, I've only got 8 in my group. Maybe someone's watched it twice. And so, you know, and really those first 3-4 months, you know, similar, maybe it increased a little bit, 50 odd views. And, you know, and then I started seeing more and more Swedish, because you can see the analytics, which I love, by the way. I love watching the analytics and see which countries are taking, because it's quite a clear, particularly in emerging countries, it's quite a clear indication of how countries are taking up the sport. But yeah, then the Swedes started watching and it started growing and they started asking questions, which gave me more content, you know, for videos that I could create for them. And, you know, it kind of grew like that. And I thought, right, well, you know, we're making all this social media content that is based on anywhere from a beginner player to an advanced player. And 1 week is different and it's a few tips here and there, and which is, you know, fantastic. And I wish I'd have had that when I was learning. And then I thought, right, we really need to find a way so players can implement it. You know, like it's a little bit like you see a lot of educational content online. You've got, you know, all your general information, but it's not really specific to the player. And so that's what we've done on thepaddleschool.com is made that a platform specifically for players. So you get a test for your level and you get a roadmap that fits you, and you can send in your videos of your shots, and our coaches, you know, we give feedback and help you improve your game. And, you know, over the 6 years, we've gone from those 13, 14 views a video to last month, we got over 9 million views across all of our social media channels, which is obviously, you know, a massive effort, but it comes with time. I mean, I've done these videos for over 6 years and haven't missed a week video on YouTube, which, you know, is organization. And now we have a bit of a team. So, you know, otherwise there's no way I could produce 50 bits of content a week, and which is kind of what we're producing. And so, that's really where we've developed. And so now we do a lot of trips to clubs and work with clubs, help them develop their coaches, help them develop their programs, help build the community. We often do a lot of community days where everyone's invited and we have a lot of fun, and we do some clinics and training, and you know, and then we work specifically with clubs to help them develop their programs.
The very beginning of the paddle school, as I heard it from you and your brother, was that you didn't have such access to material like this when you were beginning. And I think it was about tennis, actually, but you felt that there was not enough democratically available material, educational, informational, which is what inspired you to really create this much more available material.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if I look back at my tennis, I found it hugely frustrating. Not partly for myself, but more probably for my brother. I mean, he's 8 years younger than me. He was a phenomenal player, like number one or two in Europe, a kind of under 13, under 14 stage. And he was used to playing with me 8 years older. So he hit a heavier ball than anyone in his age group, because he was used to that level of play. He won junior Wimbledon doubles. He played on the tour. And I felt that the guidance that he received was not great, and not just him, but my parents as well. They grew up playing squash, and they're good sportsmen, both of them. But they were relatively new to tennis. They hadn't got that that guidance or anywhere they could ask for support. They were going to their federation, and the federation, you know, has its difficulties, and I don't want to kind of go into those, but it's you know, there wasn't anywhere that they could turn to get help or get information, or he couldn't either. And I came away from that, and he ended up, you know, being injured and in the end ended up stopping his tennis because he just couldn't kind of get to that point where he could compete. And I look at a lot of the players that are playing now that he quite comfortably beat as a junior that are you know, top 50, top 60 in the world. And I think that's hugely frustrating that there wasn't anyone or anything out there for him to develop. And so really combine that with the experience of learning paddle without any content, it really kind of pushed me to get this right. And that's really, like, a lot of people ask why, you know, why our content quality is so high for social media. And I know it's higher than anyone else's, because all of the work we've put into it is to create that content for those people that want to learn.
It's highly pedagogical, highly recommend it. Pandy, well done for your ongoing effort and discipline in doing that. You mentioned Federation. We are recording this on the 25th of August. This will be coming out much later. But the news, the hot news of the week, is the merger between the Premier Paddle and World Paddle Tours. What is one word or how do you view that merger?
Yeah, I think it's great for the sport. And it's needed to happen for a while. You know, we've had World Paddle Tour and Premier tournaments, and you've also got the A1 that are giving tournaments. And, you know, you feel like the Premier is a great set of tournaments. Now they've, you know, at this stage, finally had a women's tournament, which finally should have been from the beginning, but is part of the program now. And I feel like the combination with the World Paddle Tour, because World Paddle Tour events are great, particularly in Spain. They are great events. They're well organized. They are definitely, you know, showcasing the sport of paddle. And I think that the FIP and the Premier does really great events at the top, but then below the kind of, I would say, the amateur to pro level, your challengers, as it were, right the way to European and World Championships are relatively poorly organized. You know, and so I think that this combination will be hopefully the best of both.
Golden point or deuce?
I have to say, at the beginning, I was not a fan of golden point. But now I appreciate it. I was tournament organizer for the 2015 World Paddle Tour in Dubai, and we had our schedule, and I'm someone who likes to stick to a schedule, and we didn't have golden point in those days. And I think the first ladies semi-final took over 4 hours, and
oh my gosh,
and it ended up just throwing the whole schedule out of whack. And so I can definitely see the point of it, and actually I quite like it now. I think it adds an element to a game, not only as a spectator but also as a player. It puts that little bit of pressure on, not only on that point but also on the point or two before, because if you know that you have that at juice, then you know, you kind of want to avoid that situation if you can.
Yeah, I was chatting with my friend Juan Gutierrez, who coaches the Spanish masculine male team, and he's like a big fan of the golden point. Pressure. All right, listen, let's talk a little bit about you, Sandy. Your game, your paddle game. What's your highest ranking? Where are you in the world's ranking these days?
Oh, Minta, well, I'm on a steady decline, unfortunately, at the
moment.
Oh,
like it. Like me, age. Age is a thing, isn't it?
Age is a thing. And as I do more clinics and more coaching and more content, it's less and less time for training, really, which it's partly not helped by the current number of courts in the UK and the options to train. When I left Dubai, I left a very nice facility with some very good players, and I moved back to the UK thinking the growth would be a little faster than it has been. And so I struggled to find good players and a good facility in the UK. So I've almost thrown myself a bit more into you know, the coaching and the traveling and that side of things for now. So I'm hoping that when it develops a little bit, I'll get back on the training court. But yeah, at the moment, I moved from left side to right side, and now I'm, you know, steadily playing more and more conservative paddle. So that's my paddle.
Yeah, but you have been on the GB team, correct?
Yeah, I'm still on the GB team until some younger legs knock me out. But I mean, the really interesting thing with paddle is, I really think it takes such a long time to get to grips with the game and understand the game. So, you know, experience is, particularly if you can play on the right side and you can play a bit more conservatively, the combination of experience and also understanding how to play with partners and bring out the best in your partner and bring out the best in your game against your opponents. Like that is a kind of intangible that is really important in a match. And so that's almost what I bring. A lot of our British team are quite young. And so that's something that I definitely bring to that team. And so, you know, I think I've got another year or two left in me until before I hang up my rackets.
I'm going to say many more years, Sandy. And I think it sounds like locker room experience in a rugby team, that ability to bring wisdom, some perspective. Obviously, there's in play commentary as well. I'd love to have you tell us about, and I'm guessing why, but who are your favorite pro players to watch?
Oh, good question. I just on that thing of locker room, I think this is really interesting. And this is really interesting from tennis players to paddle, is that, like, I'm playing, you know, the younger players in our team are playing FIPs and they're playing tournaments and they're gradually building up their match experience. But when I moved to paddle, I was probably sitting on thousands of tennis match experience, you know, and the college system is great for that you play pressure match after pressure match. So it is that locker room thing, but it's also that calmness on court and that change of end that, you know, look, like, I've been there. Whatever the game score or situation is, or the tie in the number of matches, I've been there multiple times. And so whether it's tennis or paddle, so it's that calmness, I think, that really helps as well. But favorite players to watch, I mean, I you cannot not enjoy Cuello and Tapia as a pair. And you know, the same with really LeBron and Galan. And I think I'm glad that Cuello and Tapia are pushing up, because I think that they both behave really well on court. They're professional, they're youngsters, they do things right. And I think, you know, it's great to watch them. I'm going to throw one out right, you know, left field here a little bit. And I love Dineno as a player, because I just think he is underrated in the way that his tactical view on the game is so good, but you don't really see it as a right court player. You don't see the way that he controls the game, you know, with his lob. And I mean, his lob is phenomenal. And so many players say it's the most important shot in the game. And I mean, he's one of those players that I just enjoy watching, because I enjoy how he just really controls the speed, really sets it up. And I'm glad he's playing with Stupa. And actually, Martin and Stupa, they came to one of my first exhibition tournaments in Dubai when they were like 16, and they just blew the rest of the field out of the water. And it's like these little kids come over from Argentina, and they flew with their dads because they were underage. And it was really nice. They were fantastic players, and you know, they played together that whole kind of junior season. And now I'm glad they're back playing together again.
And of course, that was before Martin had his accident.
Yeah, that was brutal. You know, a lot of people don't know that, but to come back from that with, you know, I mean, two fractured legs, and to, you know, to be able to compete at this level, I mean, it takes an enormous amount of grit and determination.
Beautiful. All right, Sandy, your favorite shot. What's your favorite shot to play?
My favorite shot would be the Vibra, probably.
Mm. And is that on the left or the right?
Generally the left. I mean, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing more satisfying than playing it from the left-hand side, you've got a bit more space. You can take your time a bit more on that shot and really get into it. It's not as easy to play on the right for many reasons, partly because of the space and the opportunity. But yeah, generally would be the left.
Yeah, totally. I had the same feeling. I'm, of course, let's say, condemned to play on the right unless I'm playing with a lefty. And hitting that vibra from the right is such a different feel, different look. What about a stroke that Sandy needs to improve on?
A stroke that Sandy needs to improve on? I'm not taking my time because I can't think of one, Mitch. I'm just taking my time.
Which one are you going to choose?
To select between them. I think the shot that I find the most difficult when I haven't been playing regularly is the lob. And that for me is one that when I play regularly and like if I go to World Championships or European Championships and I play day after day for a week, I feel great by the end of the week and I feel really accurate and consistent with the lob. But particularly those first few days is getting the right depth and getting the right kind of, you know, like angle on it and the right trajectory. And that's a shot that if I haven't played for a while, it takes a little bit of practice and takes me a little bit of time to get into. So I'd probably say the lob.
Brilliant. Well, I want to just dig in 1 second because it makes me think left backhand or forehand, because my situation is I feel much more comfortable with my backhand lob, especially when I'm playing left, getting that lob cross court, getting that height. I go down, I go, but on my forehand, I feel like I like to cheat with that one almost between the legs, the one that comes at you. When you sort of spoon it back up, as opposed to what I would call a more classic paddle lob, which is, you know, from low all the way high, I feel better on it. Do you have any distinction for that, or is it both sides?
Well, I think you bring up an interesting point of the purpose of the lob. And so when we teach at a beginner level, we're very much focused on the lob is an attacking shot and you should force an easy ball and play the lob on an easy ball so that you can take the net. And as you get better and better, part of the reason you do that is risk. You don't want to hit a bad lob so that you get in trouble. And as you get better, you can play it in more and more difficult situations because you know you can hit a consistent lob until you get to Martin Dineno, who could play that lob on whatever you hit into that corner, you know, and he knows that he can drop it, you know, half a foot from that glass where he wants it. And so I think, you know, along that journey, what I find is that I go for a lob on a ball that I know that if I'm playing regularly, I could play a good lob on. But as I haven't been, I'm slightly out of touch. And then I would hit a little bit short or hit a little bit so that it bounces too much off the back glass or whatever it might be. But, you know, the idea is that forehand or backhand, it's the same for me. It's more about the decision making on that lob and, you know, playing it at the right time. And as I gain, you know, more and more consistency back in my game, I can go for that lob on a slightly more difficult ball, if that makes sense.
Love it. Well, lots of nuance in these shots. How about describing yourself as a paddle player? And I'd like you to use the metaphor of an animal to describe Sandy, Sandy the paddle player.
These are some good questions here, Minta. I think if I would describe originally, I would play, you know, very, very much like an aggressive, you know, coming forward, attacking volleyer, you know, attacking off a lot of balls, hitting quite hard from the back. Like that's when I was playing more regularly from the left-hand side. As far as an animal for that, I would like to think it's one of those kind of aggressive felines. But now I definitely play a lot more steady, a lot more controlled, a lot more like trying to open the court and being more selective with how I go about, you know, getting into that position. I'm really trying to set the ball up for my partner to finish and putting my opponent in more difficult situations. I don't know. I suppose a monkey. I wouldn't mind thinking of myself as a monkey on the right-hand side, Minta, yeah.
Love it. Excellent. Thank you for that, Sandy. How about the funniest thing that ever happened to you on a paddle court? I mean, there are probably many things, but give us something that pops into your mind?
Something that just pops into my mind, and I've been very fortunate in Dubai in that I was involved in a lot of people coming to the court. We had a lot of celebrities, and we had LeBron and Bella and Galan all come and train at our facility. And so one day we played an exhibition match, and it was one of the local coaches with Galan against myself and another coach. And we played, and he'd been training at our facility during the day, and I'd had a little bit of training with him, and then we went on the exhibition court. And you know, obviously now you've got a lot of people watching. It's a big occasion, and playing the first set, he is like lightning. Like, it's very difficult to describe if you haven't played against someone like that. I mean, he knows where the ball is going before you're hitting. Like, and add that to the fact that he is incredibly athletic. It's like, how on earth do I hit a winner against someone like this? And I had the opportunities, and no matter what situation I put him in, he'd put that ball back up. And so I tried to disguise a smash against him where the ball was coming up, and I thought, right, I'm going to look like I'm going here, but I'm going to try and change to try and catch him off guard and hit a little bit faster and flatter to bring it back down the line. And what happened was that he kind of read it halfway through, and he would have definitely got there, but I ended up like hitting as hard as I could, and it hit him in, you know, the rather painful area. And he would, you know, double down, was lying on the floor on the court. And this is before like a World Padel Tour, like the following year. I was thinking, oh my God, what have I done? And I was partly worried about his World Padel Tour next week, and partly worried about if he ever wanted revenge later on in that set.
Because he could surely... Yeah, you could surely get there. All right. Well, lovely, great story. Yeah, the crown jewels. Who hasn't had that moment? Mm. All right. Last question for you, Sandy. What life lesson has paddle brought to you?
Life lesson has paddle brought me. This is a good one. I think, and I think what's interesting is the life lesson, and it's something that I'm trying to apply to the business and other areas of my life, is that patience and consistency win the day, really. And when I think about that as a life lesson for paddle, I think about that as not only like my playing experience, my coaching experience, patience and consistency with players, but also their experience. Like, I often find that players are trying to really rush and do what the pros are doing and do it, when really it's just building blocks. It's building solid building blocks. And a lot of people say, and I get this on a very regular basis, where they say, oh, I love your videos, I'm going to make these videos too. And I think, fantastic, go for it. But just bear in mind that it's been, you know, it's been very, very consistent over a number of years to get that build up. And it compounds after, a number of years. But patience and consistency is king, I think, and king on the court, king as a coach, in a business. I'm sure you would probably agree with that in the work that you do as well. And I think that it's having that is key, really. And that, so I'd say that has been my life lesson.
I love it, Sandy. I think it's a great lesson or life lesson for parents too. Mm. Be patient and consistent in the way you bring up your children. Sandy, beautiful. Thank you for coming on The Joy of Paddle. Tell us how we can follow you. What are the best ways to see what you do, your work, track you down? Insta Sandy, what are the best links?
The best place, well, I'm on The Paddle School at every single channel, really. And we, you know, make a point of really being engaging. So if you do write, it is usually me who's writing back, or if you've posted a video in our community, it's almost always me. We have a free trial on thepaddleschool.com. So if anyone wants to go and try, test it out and, you know, see our content, our tutorials, our roadmaps, and send in some videos, that's a great way to do that. And I'm just happy to have more positive people in the paddle community. So please do come and say hi.
Keep up the phenomenal work, Sandy. Great to have you on the show. Listen to your energy and your lessons. I loved it very much. Vamos, Sandy!
Thank you very much for having me, Minter. An absolute pleasure.
So I hope you've enjoyed this Joy of Paddle episode. Please don't forget to subscribe to be the first in queue for the next episode. And if you like what you hear, please do share around with other paddle aficionados. This is a sport that deserves to be played by absolutely everyone. And if you've got a story that you'd like to share, please send me an email, or a, better yet, a voice note at nminterdial@gmail.com. With that, thanks for listening. And see you on the next episode of the Joy of Paddle podcast. Vamos!
Running should be simple. Just put on your shoes and go. And yet, when you try to learn about how to get better at it, especially as you age, you're confronted with conflicting advice, complicated workouts, and confusing nutrition trends that just won't work for you. On The Planted Runner, I'll share exactly how to run faster, longer, and feel great doing it at any age, because you don't have time to waste. I'm Coach Claire Bartholik, and I went from not running at all in my late 30s to finishing a marathon in 2:58 at age 42, all on a plant-based diet. I've helped hundreds of runners achieve new personal records well into their 60s and even 70s with science-backed training, plant-based nutrition, and proven mental strength techniques. Each episode of The Planted Runner is like a private coaching session on the run, where you'll learn from me and the guests I interview. You'll get actionable lessons to help you become a better runner every week and reach goals you never thought possible. Whether you're training for your first 5K or your 50th marathon, take along The Planted Runner on your next run. Let me show you how your best running is still ahead of you.